Welcome to the Metal Tech Podcast, this region's leading business podcast, shining a light on technology, entrepreneurship, and the future of business in Kentucky and beyond. Our goal is to advance the ecosystem by bringing attention to the founders, changemakers, innovators, and those supporting them. Metal Tech's content can be found on your favorite podcast streaming app, social channels, and YouTube. We encourage you to follow and participate in the conversation. Let's discuss and build the future. Welcome back to the Metal Tech Podcast. You've got Evan Knowles and Logan Jones here. We just sat down with Christopher Day from Indianapolis. He's the co-founder and CEO of an awesome company called Demand Jump, and they're building technology around how, as a company, do you know what content to create and then how do you create it? And that's a really important part of marketing for anybody that is trying to drive revenue and drive people to their website, drive people to whatever they're trying to drive attention to is content marketing. And Demand Jump is really helping a lot of businesses do this, from small companies that are just starting to Fortune 500 and Fortune 250 companies. They've kind of gone across the board. They've raised just under $20 million, which is great for this region and great for Indianapolis. So it was an awesome conversation.
Yeah, I think my common takeaway from this conversation was just simplifying this thing that can be so daunting to think about, which is SEO and content marketing and just marketing in general. Christopher does a great job of taking that kind of beast of a thing, that really complex thing when you think about it, of SEO and all of that, and making it simple. And it kind of boils down to just providing value to the people that you're trying to talk to. And he goes over talking a lot about just answering their questions. And that's a lot of what Demand Jump is doing, is just identifying, you know, what is your target audience asking in relation to what you're providing.
And then being able to attribute it to real revenue, which is very hard.
Yeah.
And they figured out a way to do it. So it's like you write a blog, you create a video, make sure you got the right keywords in there, making sure you're answering the right questions and making sure that the intent of your users and customers is being reflected in that content, but then being able to drive results off the back of that and show those results is really difficult. And they've seemed to have cracked that.
Yeah. It's like they could have done the first part of that and had an excellent business, but the fact that they have gotten that on the back of it is a really, really intriguing business model, and it's going to be successful. I have no doubt about it. So it's a conversation we really enjoyed. He also had some awesome insights about what he calls the nation's nucleus, and the ingredients for, as we say, making all ships rise when the tide comes in. We're really excited for you guys to take a listen. So before we dive in, we just want to get a quick word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Land Betterment. Land Betterment is doing some incredible work throughout Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky as they are taking abandoned strip mines and putting sustainable businesses in their place. These businesses not only provide a useful repurposing of the land, but they also provide great jobs to replace the mining jobs that were lost when the mine was shut down. To learn more about Land Betterment, you can listen to our interview with their founders, Mark Jensen and Kirk Taylor, on episode 97, or visit their website at landbetterment.com.
We're also sponsored by Airwing Ventures. Airwing helps determined entrepreneurs seeking resources to grow with capital and connections in order to build successful companies and impactful legacies. They're all about high growth companies, high growth careers, and high growth communities. I've personally known Dan Beldy for about 4 years now, and I've seen the work he's been doing in the community, and we should all feel very blessed and grateful that a VC like himself is here in Kentucky. I encourage you to connect with Airwing and learn more. Let's all grow this state together. You can reach out to Dan at info@airwing.vc or dan@airwing.vc. And their website is www.airwing.vc. Everybody, this is another interview that was given to us via intro from Jake Budler at Endeavor. He's been hooking us up with all kinds of great intros. Today we're sitting down with a co-founder and CEO of a company called Demand Jump, and they're growing very quickly. They're out of Indianapolis. His name is Christopher Day. We're looking forward to jumping into his product and the way he views this part of the United States when it comes to founding a company and the ecosystem. So Christopher, thanks for joining.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here, Evan.
Appreciate it. We're looking forward to the conversation. So before we get into Demand Jump, the company you founded, or you know your views on this region, let's understand where you come from. So give us kind of the overview of you know where you're from, the education and the professional background up until Demand Jump.
Sure, absolutely. So I grew up on a small farm in the middle of nowhere, about an hour north of Indianapolis. And my parents were German Baptists, which I always describe as Amish people with wheels. So literally grew up on a particle board floor, tiny little farm. We plowed the fields with a three-bottom plow, had 5 acres of garden, and took vegetables to the farmer's market, right, and sold quarts of strawberries for $1.25 at a time. So that's where I grew up. I went to Purdue, and I was in the school of technology there, and specifically I focused on construction management. And originally I thought growing up that, I guess at 16, I knew exactly what I was going to do when I grew up. I was going to grow up and own my own commercial general contracting company, and I was going to own a Blazer and a bag phone. And that's how I would measure my success. I've never had a Blazer or a bag phone.
What is a bag phone?
It's the original cell phone.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, they carried around a phone in a little suitcase and a little satchel, a little bag.
We're too young. That's showing our age here.
It was like a phone in a Dobb kit, basically.
That's great.
So anyways, I always knew I wanted to do my own thing and thought that was going to be a commercial contractor. So we had no money. We were broke. We were expected to go to college and we just kind of figure out how you're going to do it. And so next thing I knew, I started my first company at 19, a painting company, had 14 employees through college. That's how I paid for college. And then I got out and I did go and do commercial contracting and commercial development for about 5 years. And then I realized really what I wanted to be was I wanted to own my own commercial development company. But the problem was I was 26 years old and, you know, I had a great paying job, but I had no net worth. And one of the folks I had the painting company with called up and said, I heard you're back in town because I'd moved to Atlanta for about 5 years out of school. And I came back to Indianapolis knowing I was going to start something. And so next thing I know, I start my first tech company, totally kind of by accident. It was called Starcom Broadband. And we had cable internet telephony. We did it in Indiana, Michigan, Oklahoma. And long story short, we figured out how to turn on and turn off people's cable, you know, from our office in 3 different states. And next thing we know, Comcast bought us. And so that was a great day. Didn't know what we were going to do next. And my partner and I got a phone call from one of our customers and said, hey, I have these utility problems. The next thing we know, we started a utility company. It's called ViaStar Energy. And so basically we were submetering people's water in their apartments, water, gas, and electric. That turned into municipalities. So we developed a technology in conjunction with Motorola and took that product to market and ultimately exited that company to Motorola. And then we sold the billing software we had built off to a company called National Water and Power out of California. So that was pretty fun. The first, what was that, about 8-9 years, those two companies during that same. And so we sold one to Comcast and then Motorola, National Water and Power. We sold a few of our assets off to Time Warner as well. So it was really fun, right? Working with that caliber of those types of companies. During that same stint, we did get our fix in commercial development. We did several commercial development projects. And we also were at a bottled water company as well. And so 4 companies in, I think it was a total of like 10 years, I was exhausted. And so I was going to take 2 years off, do nothing. And like any good entrepreneur, that took about 3 months. I felt irrelevant. And the next thing I knew, we started an investment banking boutique called Navidar Group. And so we did mostly domestic deals, but some cross-border work, M&A work, a little bit of capital raising, but focusing on the middle quarter of the country. We kind of call it this middle diamond of the country, where there's a lot of great tech companies, but all the tech bankers sit in New York or San Francisco, and they parachute in, you know, for big deals. But you know, there's lots of great $5 million, $20 million, $50 million tech companies that need tech bankers to understand tech to sell them. So that's what we went and did. I did that for 5 years. I cashed out because I was used to being the person sitting on the other side of the table. But I learned a lot. It was a great experience. Did a dot-com business during that same era. And then, I met my current partner during that stint of the investment banking. And I'd always been frustrated with marketing. I think marketing is the hardest job in the C-suite of any company. think it's harder than sales, it's harder than finance, it's harder than ops, harder than warehousing, harder than manufacturing. And the reason is, with this little thing called the internet that came along, marketers can't see, touch, and feel what's going on. Every other department has the luxury of finite numbers, right? You can see, touch, and feel things. You can put these numbers into some kind of a platform from which you make better decisions. Marketers, you know, it's no longer about putting up billboards or making sure you locate your store in the middle of town. You know, you have to understand what that target market's thinking, et cetera. So long story short, that's kind of how we got to Demand Gen, was just the pain that I felt at, what was it, 6 or 7 companies at that point in time. Oh, I had some trampoline parks too. I forgot about that.
I saw that when I was looking at your LinkedIn, and that just kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's more of like a, you know, an investment, right? We had a person that was a rock star that ran those for us, but exposed to many different verticals, right? All those businesses were in different verticals, but there's, you know, a lot of business I believe is the same. It doesn't matter if you're building high tech or if you're, you know, digging trenches for plumbing. Like the concepts of business and execution are very similar. And one thing that's definitely the same across the board is marketing, right? How do I reach the most, in the most efficient way, how do I reach my target customer, right? And so that's how we got here. So I'll pause there.
That is a crazy and impressive background. And I can only imagine the amount of learnings that you've had from all of those different companies that you started. One thing that kind of caught my attention right at the beginning as you were diving into your background is what I kind of define as the sweaty startup, which is kind of the painting company, the service labor-based companies. Yep. In your perspective, what did you learn from those companies that you were able to take into more of the tech side of things when you got to that stage of your career?
Yeah, this is probably going to sound overly simplistic, but I think a couple of high-level things. Number one is do what you say you're going to do. So I would go around in a rental car and burn up the brakes over a weekend or two, and I'd hand out 4,000 flyers, hand-to-hand combat to mailboxes, and we might get 3 jobs. Every single job that we rewarded was referral-based. And at one point, I think my record was painting literally 6 houses in a row on the same street back-to-back. And it's because of the simple concept of we did what we said we would do. We finished the job efficiently. We did the punch list immediately. And if it was a multi-day job, we cleaned up. And what happens when you do that? People talk about it. And they go to their cocktail parties and they would say, you know, this little boy, right? And that's how you get jobs. It was that simple. And the other thing was burnout. I worked the crew too hard, right? I worked from 6 o'clock in the morning to midnight doing all kinds of things, right? I mean, it was getting paint or doing bids or cleanup work or getting the crew organized, running the sprayer, you know, going out and doing new estimates, et cetera. And I kind of had this mentality that, well, just everybody works that way. Well, they don't, right? They're getting paid hourly and they're there to do a job and do a good job. And then they're going to go home, and that's what they're paid to do. But I didn't understand that. And so we had a moment where a big chunk of the crew almost left because I was overworking them. I just was not, the emotional intelligence was not recognizing that, you know, these are unfair ass, right? So I would say, do what you say you're going to do, follow through, and, you know, don't overcommit, and then have emotional intelligence, the emotional quotient of the people around you, what they're good at, what their skill set is, what they want to do, and make sure you put them in a position of success and not burnout.
Yeah, it's incredible how far ahead just doing what you say you're going to do would put you from the competition. I mean, there's so many people who overpromise, who underdeliver. So just fulfilling the promises and the commitments that you make, I think that is an excellent simplified learning that you had from that experience. So I hope that's one that our listeners take away for sure. And then the burnout thing, I mean, that's one that I feel like our culture is definitely struggling with right now as you kind of reconcile with hustle culture. I feel like the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way, but definitely something that you have to have that emotional intelligence, especially if you're leading a team. You got to be really in tune with them. So those are awesome learnings. Thanks for sharing those. So I'd like to kind of hop into Demand Jump now. So talk about, you know, when you actually identified a problem, what that problem was, and how Demand Jump went about solving it.
Yep. At a high level, marketing is about one high level thing. And that is, that how do I drive awareness that people who would have the pain of what I'm trying to solve, to make them aware that, hey, I exist and we try to help solve this pain. And the way marketing has evolved is, and I think it's also human nature, we all want to tell you or tell each other how great we are, well, how smart we are, right? We have domain expertise, and I'm just going to bring, you know, proverbial, bring your fist on the table and like, no, you should buy. So we're so great. Well, maybe we are, or maybe we aren't. But what's more important than what I think is what you think. And so, you know, it's the concept of listening. But again, I can't be present as a marketer all over the world at all times of the day to know what are people asking about, or what are they searching, or more, even more difficult is what are they actually thinking? Well, whatever I think when I'm trying to solve pain comes out of my brain through my arms and my fingertips onto a keyboard and goes onto the internet. That's what I'm thinking. So our whole thought process is, what if we could turn everything on its head? So the internet, right, search engine, social tools, they were built for consumers, for people to find information, products, and services. It was not built for products, services, and information to find people. And so all the folks I just mentioned, they all cater to consumers. They don't care about the company, right? Because they're trying to give you and I in our personal capacity a great experience. Well, what if we could tell the marketer for any given topic, the most powerful questions or searches that are being asked and conducted, all ranked in order of how they're connected on this thing called the internet, right? So this question here is more powerful than this series of questions to this next question. So if I knew that these most important questions that the connectivity tissue or the searches that are being conducted, that are connectivity tissue, and I focused on those power centers, then by default, I will win the war. Because instead of talking about myself, I'm answering questions that you actually have, right? Or I'm showing up when it's all about intent, right? I'm showing up on the searches you're conducting when you have intent to help soothe or solve pain or to answer a question. And now I'm building trust. I'm building virtual trust. Even though we haven't met yet, I'm answering your questions time and time again as you ask all these different types of questions. And so that's what Demand Jump's really about. If you look at any study out there, this has been going for probably a decade. It used to be you could brute force your way with paid efforts, right? When the internet first came about, I could brute force paid efforts. I could show up on page one. That's not the case anymore. And when I can brute force it, it's extremely, extremely expensive and it's not sustainable. So we believe that what's missing in the marketing suite is a strategy platform, a marketing strategy platform, that the foundation is organic content. What do I need to write about that people actually care about and want to read? And I publish that virtually guarantees me more first page rankings than anybody else in my ecosystem. That's solution number one that we've solved. And I mean this in a confident way. I wouldn't have said this over the last 5 years, but watching now what we've solved over the last 18 months, I believe that Demand Jump's the best in the world. I think we are the best in the world at informing exactly at the push of a button. Now you enter a topic, and a topic can be calculator, coffee cup, customer success software. You enter a topic and it maps the entire world in about 10 minutes around that topic through the lens of whatever you're doing. And it spits out, write this article first, write this article second. And you click another button and it gives you the exact content brief that's all structured properly. You write for that structure, you overlay your domain expertise or your art, you publish it, and you go straight up. That's not good enough though. So now I'm driving traffic. A couple of fun stats is, you know, person in the studies out there, there was a Vidya Peters, who's the CMO for Marketa, was just talking about this on the Saster podcast. 61% of marketers believe the hardest part of their job is driving traffic and rankings. I think that number is actually higher. Maybe some marketers don't want to admit it, because 90.63% of web pages and blogs get zero traffic. Well, so what if we went to bed tonight and knew that 9/10 of our day tomorrow is going to be a waste of time? That would not be fun if we were aware of that. But that's what's happening. And it's happening with 9 out of 10 companies. So the first pillar I talked about of the platform is content, right? SEO, organic, driving first page ranking. So if you go look at, like, we care about content creation, we're on the first page. We also care about marketing attribution, which is the second pillar, the bookend. Now, measuring all that stuff, connecting sales and marketing together once and for all. And if you search marketing attribution, you'll find Demand Jump on the first page as well. And so those are the two bookends that matter to marketers. What in the heck should I do? What is my strategy to sell my thing? And then measuring all those actions, closing the loop with the sales team. Is it working? Is it driving closable revenue? So we can measure that every step of the way of driving the qualified traffic increases your leads, increases your close won customers, all while doing that by decreasing your cost per lead. And these numbers are like 12x increase in traffic, right? 6x increase in leads. It's exponential growth in first page rankings. You know, 3.5 to 4x decrease in your cost per lead, rinse and repeat.
So one question I have is organic content. There's lots of ways to create content. What kind of content are you seeing is most effective? I'm sure blogs is up there, but are you seeing a good mix of blogs and videos? Are people doing cool podcasts? Do those things help with keywords and SEO? Talk about the different types of content that you're seeing and how they perform.
Yep. We definitely see that videos is critical. So when we think about content, that's a great question. When we think about content, it is what are the questions that we should be answering and what are the keywords that are important to answer those questions by subcategory, right? So let's say it's marketing attribution or content creation is the pillar. Well, in content creation, there's going to be, you know, there's probably 1,500 things that I should do, right? And then I want to know what's the order I should do them in. So in that structure of content, if I repurpose that on video or in my podcast or my SEO on page content, it's still the same content. Does that make sense? So I still should be answering a specific set of questions in a specific order and layering in a few critical keywords for that to align to that customer journey, for that to align to that target prospect.
Yeah. And I think it's smart. You know, one thing that I'm trying to be conscious of with my startup that I'm doing and I'm doing content marketing with is I'm trying to make sure that, you know, we do a good job of creating content that's blogs, podcasts, and then we'll get to videos. Videos is a little bit more hard. You know, there's a lot more of a lift there. But I think with certain software tools today, it's almost to the point where we could film a video that is transcribed, and there's also an audio file that is saved. And it's like in one take, we're doing this with MiddleTech. It's like we can film a video, get the transcription of it, create a blog out of it, and then just get an audio clip and create a podcast out of it. We're getting to that point where content is just becoming, you know, easier to create. And now the question I think becomes to your all's point is what kind of content do I create?
Exactly.
Because the process of creating it is becoming much easier. And then here later in the conversation, we want to get into, you know, some of the cool stuff with AI coming. But that's how I'm starting to look at content is how can I leverage some of these tools to allow myself to create multiple types of content, different channels. And I haven't really thought as much about your all's point, which is what type of questions do I need to be answering? I don't think I've really thought deeply enough about that. So yeah, really looking forward to diving more into yours.
Here's a fun, just quick example in B2C. Okay. So 75% of our customers are B2B or agencies that serve B2B, and then the balance are B2C. But we were talking with a company at one point, and so we entered into the topic lipstick. And the most powerful question in the world for lipstick is, what does lipstick stand for? That's what the target market's asking. That's what they're thinking about. Not one of the manufacturers, zero, were answering that question.
Right. And so what, how did you all know that and they didn't? Where are you pulling your data? Is there an open Google API? I know some of it might be proprietary. Maybe some of it isn't. But how do you all get the answers?
Yep. So we realize the data is not the proprietary part. We get our data from the same place anybody else would get their data, right? There's publicly available APIs. There's paid sources. There's free sources. So where we get the data, no secret. And we pull it in from about 30 different places. And so the secret is the math. And so we did get a patent on our core thesis last year, was awarded. But the concept is, it's ranking things with temporal effects. I'm going to go within a competitive environment. So I'm going to go back to this prop. Like, this is the internet, right? The internet is a graph. It's three-dimensional, right? And it's always changing. And it expands and it contracts and it expands, right? Different ecosystems pop up. And so it's applying math to that data to put it into a graph to understand how words are related to each other in the most powerful ways, to figure out what clusters of words, in essence, are the most connected to all other words. And so that's how we get, so these little black spots here, if you can see, these little black spots would be, that's a really powerful question. This one over here, this little connected point that's not a little black dot, that's not a powerful question. So it's going to get ranked lower. So based on connectivity, how closely connected are words to each other in a given ecosystem? And then we unravel that to rank them in order of which ones are more powerful than the next one. And if I focus on the most powerful connection point, that's going to propagate throughout the internet more than anything else will. So we're not the first ones to think about networks. So what's LinkedIn? It's a network of people. That's it. What's Facebook? Same thing. It's a network. It's a network of people. So they say, hey, you might also know. And you're like, holy shit, how do they know I know such and such, right? It's just a network where they're based on algorithms. They're connecting people and figuring out the highest probability that these two people might know each other.
So now to take that a step further, once you guys have this kind of network and the words and questions that these marketers need to be considering with their content, how are you guys actually helping them take that next step and create the content? Because I saw a lot of that in your tutorial videos as well.
Yep. So once you see those questions ranked in order, for example, I literally, if I look at the top one, I'm like, yep, I want to write about that. You can literally click that button and in another 30 seconds, then it sucks in all the related words to that question, all the connected words to that question. And so what it provides is a content brief that gives you an H1 tag, H2 tags, and then the clusters of keywords that should be associated with each one of those H1 and H2 tags. And you can slide that up and down for a short or a long article. So think of blog versus white paper, right? And so if I'm gonna do something that's 500 to 1,000 words, I can just scroll that thing back and it tells me what's the most relevant in the small article. Or if I want to pull it all the way out and do like a pillar topic, like a 3,000 or 5,000 word thing, then it just keeps expanding out. These are the most connected words that matter. And then they just write.
Man, that sounds like such a cool tool. I'm going to have to definitely play around with it more. But something that's kind of an underlying theme or, you know, the reason that we're considering these networks and wanting to write content in a good way is because of SEO. So I think SEO is one of those kind of marketing buzzwords that people hear all the time and not many people actually understand. So give us a brief overview on what SEO is and then kind of relate that into how Demand Jump is helping with the actual SEO part of it.
So our thought process around SEO or organic is it's evergreen, right? So to us, SEO is knowing how to write words that align with what my target market cares about. It's that simple. So content's the core, right? And let's say there's like 12 or 24 things I enter. Well, when I enter all those in, I go, okay, this is what these different ecosystems look like. This one's pretty frothy. It's got, 20 million people looking for this thing. I'm going to start there because I think I can win or that aligns most closely to what I'm actually doing. And so then we call that a pillar. So that pillar would be content creation and sub pillars would be content marketing or content execution, content strategy, whatever they might be. And then all the blogs underneath that. So I tie my pillars to my product pages. And so everything links together. It's very intentional. So I'm writing a bunch of blogs about content, and some of those blogs are more about creation, some are more about execution, some are more about strategy. So those link up into my sub pillars, and then those all link up into my main pillar of content creation. And then that is directly aligned with my product page about content creation. And so everything's very tightly aligned. And now the weird thing is, because we're talking about networks and ecosystems, we might even write about how much do content writers make? Well, that has nothing to do with the banjo, right? Like, but we might know in the math that what content writers make or is content writing a good career? Well, that's not core to our business of what we really sell, but search engines sure as hell care about it because people care about it. Well, I should write an article about is content writing a good career? I'm just making up an example, right? And that's a part of filling out that network or that ecosystem so that I'm looked at as an authority, as a domain expert of being hyper, hyper aligned to what the consumer, right? Consumer, customer, buyer, they're all the same. I think we're all consumers. Doesn't matter if we're at home or at work, but it's tightly aligned to what those people are actually asking and the information they're seeking.
Yeah, I think when I think of a company that's doing this best, and rightly so, they should be, is HubSpot. Like whenever you start a company and you start searching for different topics, you know, how to raise VC money, how to create content, how to build a website. Like there's 100% chance that on the first page, HubSpot has some kind of big ass pillar blog. Inside that pillar blog, there's 5 to 10 more, and you learn everything you need to know about that topic. And what that does for HubSpot is now I trust them, like you were saying earlier. And now I'm on their website, and while I'm here, I know I need a CRM. I might as well check it out.
That's right.
And they've got that free version. Boom, they've got me. And so that's like, to me, the prime example of organic content creation becoming their funnel. That's what they were founded on. And their whole CRM is kind of built around that. Is that, you know, is that a great example to you as well? Is that the best example?
That's the best example. Because, so we see that in the platform. So 9 out of 10 companies we see are awful. Literally 9 out of 10. They're all awful. And I'm talking household names. And it doesn't matter if it's B2B or B2C. It's not because they're not smart. It's because it's a really hard problem. And if you don't like put massive bodies at it, you're not going to be good at it. HubSpot crushes it. And we see that in our platform. Qualtrics does a great job at like experience management, those types of things. We're a power user of HubSpot, right? So HubSpot enables marketers to kind of do what they want to do. And so it's a great 1-2 punch with Demand Gen and HubSpot, because HubSpot enables that marketer to publish and do what they want to do with their content and run their website, but they don't tell you what you should do. They just enable marketers to do what they're already doing, to talk about their both domain expertise more. If people lead with domain expertise, it's just today it's leading it exactly backwards.
This is great stuff for our listeners that are, you know, beginning to create their marketing strategies, or in the middle of their marketing strategy, and they realize they're not great at SEO. You know, I think this is just such a cool topic to talk about, and you guys are really nailing it.
Yeah, I mean, we are literally working with Fortune 250 companies today. They're very sophisticated household names. We're working with a major marketing cloud that's a household name, down to SMBs that people haven't heard of yet, and all in between.
Yeah. So with that kind of traction, let's start to get into like just a few more of the business metrics. So you guys are raising money. You guys have raised money. You guys raised a good amount of money. Talk about the fundraising journey that you've been on, and how has being a serial entrepreneur helped you with that?
So we've raised just under $20 million, right? So what we're trying to solve is a difficult problem. We've made lots of mistakes along the way trying to solve this. Finally got it 18 months ago, 2 years ago. But I think being a serial entrepreneur, there's pros and cons. So on one hand, you know, I think the most important thing in entrepreneurship is just perseverance. Getting out of bed every day and sticking that foot in front of the other one more time. And then, let's do it again and just keep going. And there was an emotional endurance. I heard a quote the other day I loved. Emotional endurance. Because it's manic, right? There's days where you're conquering the world and you're like Superman cape. And there's other days you're fetal position, like, what the hell am I doing, right? I mean, raising capital, we all read headlines about somebody raised a round of capital and some of them look really sexy where they raised a bunch of money, whatever. The blood, sweat, and tears, the hand-wringing, the nasty conversations that probably happened to, you know, the 10 no's to find your yes, I think is probably prevalent for everybody. Just raising capital is a tough game, right? And very seldom is anybody doing something truly unique first time, right? Most times there's already 3 competitors or 30 competitors or maybe 500 competitors, and you've got a better mousetrap, right? Or a better methodology that you think you can make a little bit better. But it's also exhilarating, right? Because every no is one step closer to a yes.
Yeah, it's definitely hard. I'm going through it right now. I'm in the middle of a fundraise, and we're doing a pre-seed raise. I'm more than halfway through it, and it's been hard. You know, it took longer than I thought. If you said earlier 10-to-1 ratio of, you know, 10 meetings and one close, if I can find that ratio, I would take that all day. but it's you know, people glorify it. It's not necessarily something to glorify, and then it's not something necessarily to celebrate after it's over, because it's just one more step in the journey, and it's just one more day you get to survive if you, you know, continue to raise the money. What's it been like raising in this part of the country? Is most of your money local? What's that look like?
Yeah, so you're ready to tap on an item I'm super passionate about. I think it's difficult to raise money, to raise growth capital in the middle quarter of the country. If you're a good person and you worked hard at your previous jobs and you have an idea and, you know, you've always done what you said you would do, et cetera, and you want to go start a company, chances are you're going to raise 500, a million, million and a half, right? It's not going to be easy, but you can make it happen. And then you get a little traction and maybe you have to raise a little bit more money. But now you need to go raise 10 or 20 or 50 million. And that's where our biggest gap is, I think, in the middle quarter, is growth capital. You know, angels, you know, friends and fools, or, you know, that kind of stuff. I think we have a decently, I don't know if I'd call it frothing, but I think we have a good investor network in the middle corridor. People who can stroke a $100,000 check and some who can stroke a $500,000 check that are kind of these angel funds, right? But has it gotten easier? I don't know if I feel like it's gotten easier or harder necessarily with more experience of being through the process. I think you get to know more people in the network that are capable of doing that. But we can talk more about this in a minute. But I think growth capital is the big problem here.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. And I'm sure there's a lot of companies out there that would resonate with that as well. Before we get more into, like you just said, talking more about this region, we'd love to hear a little bit about where Demand Jump is going. I know that AI was kind of mentioned in terms of your guys' long-term plan. So yep. Talk a little bit about how you guys plan on introducing AI to grow the business as well.
Yeah, we're super excited about it. You know, there's these concepts out there with like GPT-2, GPT-3. So super high level, it looks like we're going to be able to use our own data sets to train with GPT-2. So we probably will end up sticking with that. We don't want to train, and I know there's people getting funded, starting companies doing this, right? Talking about how they're going to automate, you know, content magically.
Copy AI. You can automate your copy on your website.
Yeah. It's not going to happen with some of the open source technology that's out there. Not going to happen. And we know that for a fact, just because of the data that we see. Like to go train that on using kind of all the content in the world, like using Wikipedia, you know, in essence, is not going to produce a good result, because those models are being trained off of content that may or may not be relevant. And so we've been working on this for over a year, and I think we're getting close to having something really interesting. But we're training our models on data sets that we're feeding it. They're already curated that we know is the most powerful content that's being consumed. And we believe that will yield a much better result. And so I've already seen some outputs from it, and I'm extremely excited. And if anybody's listening that's a marketer or a content writer, it's not going to put you out of a job. I know people get scared about that. It's going to elevate you. It's going to give you more job security. And it's going to elevate you from what might seem as tactical to more strategic, where you're able to kind of, you know, guide things from a command center instead of like, you know, beating your head up with writer's block and trying to figure out how to execute. I say that all the time. I know some types of technology and AI puts people out of work, you know, with autonomous cars or trucks or whatever. Okay, I understand that happens. But it also creates other jobs, right? And specifically in marketing, we've had people, agencies, for example, initially were very scared about what we're doing. They thought that we were going to make them obsolete. It's actually going to make them stickier, because they're going to be able to drive more value more efficiently for their client base, ask for more budget, increase margins with AI-driven content. That's our, we're getting close. And we think you have to train those models off of quantifiably known relevant words.
Yeah. I think the word that sticks out to me throughout this whole conversation is you guys are helping brands and companies provide value through answering these questions. And that just seems like a very authentic and genuine way to get your brand out there. So that's what really resonates with me. And you're now taking artificial intelligence and machine learning, and I think a kind of a cheesy idea that just popped in my head about it is like you're feeding it the healthiest of data, like it's a bodybuilder. You're feeding it the relevant stuff and making it lean and making it perform well. So I can only imagine what that's going to unlock for you guys once you get to that stage. It's super exciting.
Yeah, I love that analogy, right? The right protein.
Yeah, taking it through its paces. No, I love it. So let's kind of transition now onto what you call the nation's nucleus. So walk us through your thoughts on what that is and what it's been like building that.
Yep. So there's a concept I read about called the productivity boom. And the way I kind of think about productivity boom is in reading some of these economist reports, but I think about the productivity boom as the collision of data with all industry. And so it's believed that this productivity boom is going to occur in the middle quarter of the United States. This middle quarter is super powerful. There's a lot of great stuff going on out here. And when I think about Indiana specifically, there's 7 ingredients needed to be the nation's nucleus. And so thinking through those, think about infrastructure, talent, mission-critical industry, tech, lifestyle, cost of living, regulatory environment. And so, and I'm just speaking about Indiana, right? So Kentucky has lots of incredible things going for it as well. You know, but infrastructure, so I think about if you can't move people and goods from one place to another efficiently, then nothing else matters. Well, today that's been replaced by data. Like, so rural broadband, connectivity, critical. When I think about talent, it's one of the two biggest problems I think we have in Indiana. One is talent awareness. Our talent is not aware of the tech ecosystem that exists here. And so, you know, what happens every fall at the university? We have these wonderful universities, Purdue, IU, Notre Dame, Ball State, Rose Hallman, did I say IU? So, like, look at those schools and look at tech talent, legal talent, business talent, marketing talent, journalism talent, et cetera. The list goes on. Top schools in all of their own regards. All these freshmen file in and they have tunnel vision, right? They're going to Butler, they're going to Purdue, they're going to IU because whatever, their legacy or it's one of the top engineering schools, right? But they're going there for a reason, and kids just aren't aware of all the things that are going on in the world. And so they show up and they go to school and they go through an interview process, and they've heard about Silicon Valley, you know, or they've heard about Boston, and they've heard about New York and, you know, bright lights and all that kind of fun stuff. And so then they go take their jobs there. Now, people call it brain drain. And I'm honestly not very afraid of brain drain necessarily, because I think it's a good thing if some people go to other companies, other cultures, other states, other countries, whatever, get their first jobs, learn. I think it's a great thing. And then come home and bring those learnings back. But we should be, this talent awareness issue being one of the biggest weaknesses. Why aren't we in those freshman orientation classes and courses in the auditoriums and in the classes in that first week of school, talking about the ecosystem that's happening right here, 1 mile down the road or 60 miles down the road? Nobody does it. It blows my mind. The second thing is capital formation. I think Indiana's one of their biggest, and I think this applies to a lot of middle corridor states, one of our biggest exports, that's the stealth or the silent export, is wealth. So we invest, we take all the risk. In this middle corridor, Indiana, we take all the risk, investing the $500,000, the million, the $2 million, the $3 million. And then when our winners of the winners pop out, now they need $10 and $20, $50, $100, and $200 million, all of that money comes from the coast. And when those people go public or they get bought for $500 million, $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, which we've had a lot of those in Indiana, about $7 billion worth the last 5, 6, 7 years, all of that risk-adjusted growth capital, all the returns of that, the real wealth, most of it goes to Boston, New York, a little bit goes to California, and it gets recycled there. It doesn't get recycled here. So I think talent awareness, which we just talked through, and capital formation are two things in Indiana specifically, and in the middle corridor as well, that if we focused on those two things, well, we could find ourselves in an entirely different ecosystem in a matter of 5 years.
Yeah, the talent awareness piece is super interesting to me. We talked to the Nashville Technology Council a couple weeks ago. And one of the programs that was really intriguing to me is how they were going as low as down into middle school and trying to educate those kids just about the opportunities that exist out there and then get them thinking about it all the way through college. Of course, they're doing things in high school and college as well. But I mean, that's what needs to happen, is all the way down to as young as middle school, maybe even as young as elementary school, just get those brains inspired and thinking about what can be going on. And what we're actually going to be talking to Roger Schumann with TechPoint here, I think, in 2 weeks as well. So we'll be really excited to hear about the work that they're doing, because I know a lot of the focus of those organizations is around the talent aspect of that.
You're spot on. Private companies want to be helpful and get involved and help create awareness for their future talent pools. I think it should go all the way down to K to 12. Now you have a little bit different thing you talk about, you know, to kindergartner versus a senior in high school. But just exposing these kids to what is out there. I'll give you an example. We have, I don't know, probably a dozen, maybe not quite a dozen, people that work in Demand Jump that graduated from Butler University, which is about 10 miles from our office. Some of these kids are from California, right? Chicago, wherever. They're from other parts of the country that, whatever reason, they had a passion to go to Butler. They had no idea that this tech ecosystem exists. They had zero idea, because we're not exposing them. So how do we redefine STEM? Because companies will pay. So let's get really creative with it. Make companies pay a little bit of money, because if people don't pay something, then they don't appreciate it. So make the companies pay $100, $250, $500, I don't know, just a number, every semester, to be a part of a program that sprinkles in every single day a company or a couple companies talking to these kids about whatever that company does. And maybe it's 30 minutes during, maybe it's 15 minutes during homeroom. It's just exposing them to all these different types of, you know, work ecosystems and cultures and job opportunities, et cetera, that they could do someday. Because by seeing is believing, right? And parents don't have the bandwidth to expose them to all those opportunities. These things are not hard. It's just being purposeful,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I love that entire piece of it. And something else that you mentioned, kind of the ingredients of making this area kind of rise is, you know, the cost of living part, which I think this area really needs to tout itself on, but just because of by nature, you know, the lower cost of land and just being a lot easier to kind of get your start here, which is how I'm viewing it for a young guy straight out of college, is I can stretch my money a lot further here. And then something else I'd like you to kind of touch on in terms of what you see Indiana doing well in this aspect is the regulatory environment for things like startups and things like that. So what are you seeing in that aspect of it?
Yep. So several things. And I think it's not only regulatory, but some of the nonprofit organizations like TechPoint, right, that are happening. So from a regulatory standpoint specifically, things like VCI tax credit, right, and expanding that VCI tax credit, making it, oh my God, the word's escaping me. You can buy and sell that cross-border, state to state. But so if somebody else, if I've used up all my tax credits and somebody else needs tax credits and lives in Kentucky, well, then they can buy my tax credit. We just passed legislation that enables that. SaaS sales tax credit, for example, or infrastructure incentives, right? Data center incentives, investing, you know, methodically in rural broadband. These are all examples of things that have a massive ripple effect in helping advance that technology-enabled peace along the street.
Absolutely. We see the same things that we need to be focusing on here in Kentucky as well. So I think you're putting it excellently for those who are kind of in those leadership positions within the state that we know kind of listening to this podcast as well. So we always like to kind of end on things that ecosystems are doing well and things that could be doing better just to try and provide some feedback for those ecosystems. So talk a little bit about what Indianapolis has done really well and what they could be doing better.
I think one thing that Indianapolis does really well is connectivity. So I'm just take TechPoint as an example. So TechPoint has a large board that, I don't know, Jeff, how many people are on that board, but let's say there's 50 people roughly that are kind of from all different walks of life in the technology ecosystem. And their whole mission is around connectivity, right? And connectivity of talent, connectivity of capital, connectivity of relationships. And they have real programs they put in place. I'll just mention one quickly, where they go out and scour these universities in, I think we call it extern program. And so these kids in colleges now all over the country will apply to get involved in the extern program. And they go through a series of things that they get accepted into the extern program. And let's say there's a couple hundred that awfully get selected. We invite them to Indianapolis. TechPoint houses them, feeds them, introduces them to different walks of life, the lifestyle in Indianapolis, right? And exposed, bring in speakers of various tech companies, et cetera. So you go through this whole experience for 8 weeks or 10 weeks. And the survey results of, did you know Indianapolis had a tech ecosystem? Would you consider working in Indianapolis when you graduate? Coming in, these externs, those surveys are all like 3%. When they leave, it's like 95%.
That's what we struggle with in Kentucky, is the connectivity part. You know, the way our government has situated, you know, these ecosystem supporters is, you know, city by city. Each city in Kentucky seems to have their own little hub of startup acceleration or resources, whatever it might be, but they're not really talking to each other very well. Yeah. And that connectivity has really kind of held us back from what I've seen. And, you know, Lexington has one of the better hubs. You know, we're sitting in it right now, Awesome Inc. And when you go to somebody in Louisville, you ask them, what's the connectivity like? And they just say, well, it's really bad. And that's something we need to improve on. And I think Logan has a good point that he makes about this related to Kentucky is, you know, there's not a market in Kentucky that really can stack up against Indianapolis or Nashville when it comes to the size of the startup ecosystem. So we really need to kind of just look at, even Louisville is on a different scale than Indianapolis and Nashville. So we kind of need to look at this as a statewide initiative of how do we support everybody in the state, because it's really only an hour from Lexington to Louisville, and then Louisville to, let's say, Elizabethtown or Bowling Green. So we might as well just make sure we can connect as an entire state and not set up these individual hubs. I think that's holding us back because resources are stretched in Kentucky, and just making it too local really hurts. And I love the fact that you guys are so well connected.
Yeah. And all it takes is, you know, a leader to kind of get, you know, the universities and the corporate partners. You kind of start there at a high level and get them to agree, hey, we're going to work together, right? We're going to sit around the same table once a quarter and start, you know, creating on ramps. Just create on ramps for people to get connected, capital, whatever it is, to get connected I think it's one thing they've really done well at. There's on that tech point board, there's all walks of life, you know, on there, proactively trying to pull together. We should be more confident. I'm not proposing arrogant, but I'm proposing confident, not so humble. So tell our story. Right? Don't be afraid to tell your story. It's cool to tell your story. Telling stories is cool again. But like we're just humble people, and people just kind of do their deal and
just
do the deal.
That's what we're trying to help with here. You know, storytelling, I think, is a critical component, and it's just not being done enough. Because these entrepreneurs, you know, have great experience, but the younger ones coming behind them, the only way they get to hear that experience and the localized knowledge is if they get coffee with them. And now we can start to share that with Middle Tech, and that's kind of our goal. Well, thanks so much for joining. You know, I think you walked through your product and what you guys are building, the demand jump. It's very exciting. Congrats to you all. You guys built a great product, and you guys are well on your way to success. I said on our first call, it's like, you know, HubSpot's wet dream. It feels like they would just absolutely love to you know, somehow work with you all, and maybe down the line, you know, if you don't want to take it public, there will be an exit potentially. But thanks so much for joining. We always like to, at the very end, talk about and give you a plug of, you know, where can people find you? Talk about your business and you personally, if you want people to find you personally and might want to reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. So my email is cday@demandjump.com. So feel free to plot me an email. Demandjump is demandjump.com. And my LinkedIn, I think, is only the known is Christopher Day Demandjump, and you'll find me. I think there's a number behind my name. But yeah, just reach out, and we're here to add value. So if we can help add value to anybody who might want it, love to try to help you out.